Hi, everyone, and welcome to the House of Pod. I'm Kaveh.
And I'm Lizzie.
And if this is your first time listening, we're a medical...
sort of.
...podcast where we try to discuss medicine and health in a relatable way.
And we will answer questions you may not feel comfortable asking your doctor and definitely won't bring up to your friends.
And today, we're going to do something a little bit different. We get a lot of questions about gastroenterology, as you might imagine, because we're both gastroenterologists. So we thought we'd do one episode kind of focused on GI stuff and answering a lot of the questions that we get. Why did we go into GI? What do we do when we find polyps? All that fun stuff coming up with two special guests. We have Jeff Fox, the chair of gastroenterology for Kaiser Northern California, and T.R. Levin, the chief of gastroenterology in the Diablo service area for Kaiser as well. Stay tuned.
The opinions on this podcast are broadcasted for educational and informational purposes only and do not represent the opinions of our employers. These opinions are not intended as a diagnosis, treatment, or as a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Please consult a local physician or other healthcare professional for your specific healthcare and or medical needs or concerns.
Welcome back to the House of Pod. I'm Kaveh.
I'm Lizzie.
And Joe's not here right at this moment.
LARPing?
LARPing away. Live action role playing.
Kaveh, how you doing?
I'm all right. How are you?
I'm good. It's the summertime. And do you know what summertime means?
Living's easy.
Living's easy.
Wait,
right?
That's another one.
Summertime.
Yeah, okay.
Anyway, new interns. So that means for our listeners and for Joe, who's probably listening at home, that the interns who just now, the people who just finished medical school, brand new, fresh baby doctors who just graduated like 2-3 weeks ago or months ago, are now doctors taking care of patients.
Is that why I'm hearing so many code blues being called in the hospitals?
Which is, by the way, an arrest. That means the heart has stopped. Code blue. Yeah. And it just is sort of a terrifying time. And you know, July 1st, everyone's antennas go up and everyone's so worried that, you know, all the patients are like, I don't want a student touching me. I don't want a trainee. Are you the real doctor? That kind of those questionings.
Can I ask a quick question, though? We're joking for the most part. You know, it's not like there really is, I don't think, any increased risk of death in this time. But do you think in some ways there is some benefit to having a brand new, fresh doctor? Like, you know, if you get someone who's right out of medical school, they're probably eager as can be. They're probably like at their most intense, most attentive.
They are the most eager and the most interested and the most caring, but they are literally the dumbest. I mean, I don't mean to make it sound that harsh.
That was us.
Right, totally. Yeah. We are all that person. And I don't mean dumb as in not intelligent. The least experienced in medicine, the more experience doesn't mean better. But you need a little bit of experience, you know?
You
don't want a fresh baby doctor by themselves because they don't really know, you know, the difference between a textbook and reading. And, you know, they have had hospital experience, but it's very different to know a really sick patient when you see them without knowing labs and vital signs. You can see a really sick patient. And that really is about experience. So I do think, though, that July 1st is sort of a good time to be a patient if you have to choose it, unfortunately, if you have to be a patient, because I think everyone's antennas are up, everyone's hyper aware, everyone's worried. My fear is August 1st.
Oh, can I guess why?
Yes.
Because the first month has gone by and now they feel like they know what they're doing and they really don't. Like they're like, hey, I've done this for a month. I kind of get this. And then they're surprised by something.
I think that that's a fair point that I wasn't thinking of. I think there's two things. I think there's false sense of confidence. But I also think that the supervisors, like the attendings, like you and I at this point, let your guard down a little bit. And
because we're like, they know what they're doing. They've been doing this for a month.
Right. Or just you're so hyper alert in July that in August, you just sort of go back to being normal.
Right.
And you have to remember that these July interns, the fresh baby doctors, might have been on a really easy, not real kind of rotation. Perhaps I think I started derm. I was like, what did you just call?
Sorry, derm friends.
I'm pretty sure my first 2 weeks of intern year, it was hard. And I'm pretty sure my second 2 weeks of intern year, I was forced to take vacation, which I was livid about. So that really means my colleagues, my peers had 4 weeks of training and I only had two. So really, was I that much of a better doctor on August 1st? Because the answer is no.
Right.
In case you guys were on the edge of your seats.
Very, very good point. Very good point.
Mm-hmm. Anyway, that's something that I feel like a lot of patients are so scared about, but I think it's not a bad time because I think that everyone is aware of how new and green is that
right. Yeah.
These kids are.
No, you're right. Yes, for our listeners who are patients or family members of patients, we also know that the interns can sometimes be a mess. Don't worry. We're looking at things.
Right.
We're watching.
Right. We're in on the joke.
Yeah. For you interns out there, that doesn't give you an excuse to slack off, though.
No. And I think that they're very eager. They'll take time. You should tell them about your cats and your dogs and your other troubles because they want to listen.
Right.
Before they realize how they should be moving faster.
Now, coming up next, we have Dr. Jeff Fox. He is the chair of gastroenterology for Kaiser Northern California. He's responsible for the care of pretty much all the GI folks in Northern California. Stick around. It's a great episode. Welcome back to the House of Pod. We have with us Jeff Fox, the chair of gastroenterology for Kaiser Northern California, responsible for the GI care and needs of approximately, 4.2 million people? Is that?
Big number.
It's a big number right now. I didn't mean to freak you out. Sorry. Did you know that?
I did know it, and it is true. But I try not to think about that every day.
Yeah, I imagine.
All those missed polyps. Jeez.
That's a lot of
that
people.
That keeps me up at night sometimes.
I'm responsible for every one of those missed polyps.
Yeah. So Jeff, for our listeners, and for Joe, who can't be with us today, we all do colonoscopy, and this is part of our life, part of our daily routine, and we all worry about, these are the things that keep us up at night, a missed polyp. Sometimes I'll find a polyp that's really subtle and small, and I'm like, God, if it were a different day, I would have missed that, and that terrifies me,
I hope none of our patients are listening right now.
I know.
that is true. There's a definite kind of human element to this. We're not like machines, and some parts of that are a problem. Most of them are good. Like we kind of fear that could the machines take over our job? And the answer is in no way at this time.
Right.
Maybe someday.
Right. It's not a little, now.
So, okay. This has come up before and people have asked us if we're ever worried about the robots taking over. Mm-hmm. And I will tell you why I am not, because they would do the job too well. You're going to go to your robot doctor. The robot doctor is going to take all your information. He's going to take all your complaints. He's going to compute beep, beep, boop, boop, boop. And he's going to say, you do not need pain medication. You do not need antibiotics. And the people are going to revolt.
Right.
They're going to lose their minds.
They're going to say, you're fine. Go.
Right.
You do not have cancer. All the stuff that you can find online.
Healthy eating, plant-based diet, leave.
Right. That's gonna, high fiver.
You need a psychiatrist.
Right. That's going to be it. Right.
That's very good. So to take it back, so tell us a little bit how long you've been in practice, and Kavi and I were talking earlier. What we get asked this a lot: why GI? Why gastroenterology?
So I've been at it for gulp. I got my MD in '97
from UC San Diego.
UC San Diego, right. And then did my residency in University of Washington in 2000, finished UCSF fellowship. So 2003, I was looking for work and my first job is Kaiser San Rafael. So that's 2003. So this is 15th year being a kind of full-fledged gastroenterologist. And I love the work. I think it is extremely kind of diverse. Our days, particularly since I went into leadership, every day is different. But even the specialty itself has so many different niches to it that each day really doesn't look like the last. And I knew that going into it, I knew I really liked endoscopy. I knew I liked cognitive aspects of medicine. I was procedural. I didn't want to be so procedural that's like ortho, which is a little bit.
If there is a bone, I have to fix it.
Yeah, I mean, all the stereotypes aside, it just wasn't really, cognitive enough for me. So GI was really kind of the best of all worlds, and I think it's kind of, even though it's evolved over the years, it's really kind of lived up to what I thought it was going to be.
So going back to 2003, when you're out of fellowship and you're looking for a job, why did you choose Kaiser?
Yeah, it's...
Maybe we should explain, because we do have listeners who don't have Kaisers in their model. Lizzie, how would you describe Kaiser in a one-sentence description to our listeners who aren't exposed to Kaiser?
It's so hard because it's not fee-for-service and it's not a city-county hospital. So it's some hybrid of all these things where we have trainees, we have residents, we have fellows. You know, so there's academic part of it, but that, you know, the focus really, in my opinion, is the patient and the clinical part, even though there is funding for research and there is education and teaching part of it. That was a really long sentence.
So, that was a good one, though.
Yeah, it's this very interesting model. And we can talk about medicine and healthcare in America, but I feel like my opinion, me, is that physicians should be salaried, and to think of a patient, or in our field, it's a bummer Joe's not here because it's three GI doctors right now. In our field, we shouldn't think of a procedure as a commodity. You don't want to do a procedure and get a paycheck, because then you see the procedure as an incentive when we don't want to do that. We want to do what the right thing is.
So you've been a practicing doctor out of fellowship since 2003. How have you seen medicine change in that time? How do you feel it's changing?
Well, I think the technology continues to be changing at an incredible pace. I feel like instruments we have, for instance, the optics, the assists, the
computer, the chart.
The chart has changed, not always for the better, right. But certainly the power of our electronic health record is just, it's night and day. Actually, very interestingly, it used to be a total nightmare to get records from anyone that wasn't Kaiser. It was one of the advantages of Kaiser. You know, we can, wherever you get your care in Northern California, you can just pull up their note. Mm-hmm. But now all the major health systems are on the same one. So we actually get our notes from UCSF and from Sutter. So that's actually really good. So actually, there's been some sharing. I think so. So the technology is a huge difference. I do think that the type of person that's going to medicine is gradually changing. I think that from my parents' generation, where a lot of people went into medicine for the right reasons and a lot went into it for the wrong reasons. Mm-hmm, I would say the wrong reasons would be
money.
Yeah. To make a killing. Yeah. And you could, especially, you know, if that's what your main motivation was. I just think those opportunities are fewer, and that people just have figured it out now. So the people that want to do that just really aren't doing it. And yet we are still getting really amazing people going into medicine. I can say this because, you know, my wife, she works with students and residents, and, you know, we all work with residents and fellows.
Yeah.
We're seeing fantastic people, but I feel like behind the scenes, they're a little bit less kind of. They're a little bit more aligned with, again, with like
mission kind
of
goals.
The mission goals.
I wonder if we'll see less attrition, you know, because now people might choose medicine more frequently just because of the job, as opposed to other incentives or money or whatever. So maybe we'll see people sticking to it longer. I don't know the rates. I know that, you know, we've talked, physician burnout is at very high rates or now being monitored more carefully. So I do wonder if that there'll be some correlation over the years. You mentioned your wife, so she's a doctor. So, like, tell us, everyone in your family is a doctor. Is that what we're coming to the conclusion? Because I know from your brother is a neurologist, so you keep going because that's all I know now.
Yeah.
I'm tapped out.
Okay, brother, wife, brother's wife, father, wife's father, sister-in-law's father.
Your kids are young. Are they like Doogie Howser?
Are your kids doctors?
No. Well, my kids are actually too young to be doctors.
Doogie.
No. David doesn't know that reference, but my son, I think, wouldn't mind if that ended up happening. He already knows he wants to be a gastroenterologist.
Wow.
It's like one of the first words he could spell.
Well, it's a big one too. I know, right? Wait, so do you actually know that, are they interested, your kids, in medicine?
My daughter is not interested in medicine, and that's fine. Actually, it's not only fine, it's healthy
encouraged.
And encouraged. Yep. And I kind of wonder if that's what David's going to end up doing, because, you know, he's 14, so yeah. He doesn't really know what the heck he's going to do. But, you know, it's definitely in the family. I think that I read a study once that your relative risk of going into medicine, if you have one parent, is like 10. And if it's two parents, it's like 180 or something.
Like cancer studies.
Right. I had two parents, so I was done. I was done for.
Oh, yeah.
But we've talked about this, and we had Daniel Mitchell, who's running for
Congress. Third Congressional District of Tennessee, Chattanooga. If you haven't voted for her, please do. That's
very
another
good
plug for Daniel Mitchell.
Yeah, she's wonderful. We had her on the show, and she just... is a small practice. She's a doctor, had her own practice, was on Obamacare herself, really fighting prior authorizations, all the stuff. And she said that she grew up with no influences of education or medicine. And that kind of person, it sort of just astounds me and amazes me, a person who can come without that influence. And that, because when you see your parent or your brother or whomever do it, you're like, oh,
yeah,
that's
easy.
Normal.
Right.
These people I see every day, they're normal people. We eat dinner, you know, they fart too. And I can,
everybody,
you know,
right?
Have everybody, to find a way to get that
right
in.
I should have said everybody poops, you know, the famous book. And I can do what they do because they're just normal people. And without that exposure and influence, I'm always impressed or just very curious about how people sort of get that way. And for you, I'm not interested at all.
No, it's pretty obvious. You didn't have a choice, did you?
You didn't have a choice. Anyway, so it's obviously a big thing. And you know, you say that you sort of encourage your daughter to be diverse, but you wouldn't necessarily discourage them, right? You wouldn't, you're proud, obviously, of your job now. Do you feel like the future of medicine that you would encourage them if they were like, this is what I want to do?
Yeah, absolutely. I would encourage them. I mean, I like what I do. So is my wife. And so I feel like it kind of rubs off on them a little bit. They see us working hard. I mean, they're not blind to that, but there's definitely a degree of satisfaction we both have that I hope rubs off. I don't know. If we had one of our kids going to medicine, I'd be very proud.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's, you know, we've talked about on the show before, there is, and you said GI in particular, you said there's a nice diversity in what it's, and patients ask us all the time, as Kaveh and I have mentioned before, as they're going under, when we're about to do a colonoscopy, the two most common questions, how many of these do you do a day? Because someone pointed out, they just feel like they're sort of part of this machine, like assembly line. And they just are curious about what's like before and after, like what's going on in these rooms. And the second most common question is, again, as they're falling asleep, why GI? And Kaveh is like, that's a loaded question. And I'm like, Kaveh, elaborate. What do you mean a loaded question?
Well, you know, they ask it like, not like, what? This is so interesting. Why did you go into GI?
You're so handsome. Why did you choose GI?
A model or something. But no, what they'll ask me is, what they'll ask is like, why would you do this?
Right.
Is the implication.
They look at you like, you're about to stick that thing where?
Right.
And why would you ever do this?
And I get it. I mean, trust me, I know our job is weird.
Yeah.
I know, like, there's times when I'm doing my job, I'm like, this is a weird job.
Right.
But, like, then, you know, if I have time, I'm like, well, you see, there's a cerebral component, there's a procedural component, it's a blah, blah, blah. But usually they're like half asleep by the time I have that conversation.
Yeah. Right. And that's what I love, too. I mean, the procedures, office, hospital, thinking, like there is this combination that I think is pretty rare in medicine in general that we get. And I think that for that reason, it's pretty cool. So very important. You're a GI doctor. You take polyps out of colons. What is the coolest thing you've taken out of any sort of intestinal orifice, whether it be above or below, because some of our listeners don't know exactly what we do. So I'm sure you have some fun stories from over your
maybe coolest isn't the right word, but what's
Sorry.
The most interesting thing you've
Sorry.
Removed
the
from a body?
Most perplexing.
Yeah, we get a lot okay. of questions about this.
Yeah.
You'd be surprised. People are really interested.
We all do, yes.
Right.
So I think the most maybe scintillating one, Barbie doll. This is actually on upper. It was like a psych patient on the locked ward at San Francisco General. Had swallowed something we didn't know, but they were not doing well. And the scope went in, and the first thing was seen, we went through the GE junction.
Where the esophagus meets the stomach, for our listeners.
Was blonde hair.
And it was stuck?
He swallowed a little person.
It was clearly like a bar. It was the so you couldn't really do it with all the arms and legs on. And I think it was like a mini. It wasn't like
the full size.
It wasn't the full size Barbie. It wasn't Malibu Barbie. It was just a little. But it was the head and the body with the arms and legs pulled off. But it was definitely looked like something that really would have been challenging to get down there.
Oh, he pulled off the arms and the legs. That's very considerate of himself. Right. He really thought ahead on that one.
I want to talk about the treatment strategy in this adult psych unit that involves playing with Barbie dolls. Right. How did this guy get his hand on said Barbie doll? I'm just curious. Is this part of the treatment plan? I'm not judging. I'm just curious.
I wasn't part of that curriculum in that unit. Sorry.
Yeah. That's fantastic.
Well, Jeff, thank you so much for coming on. It was a blast having you on. We appreciate everything you're doing. It is nice to see someone who has a leadership position, who is such an important administrative position, but keeps himself so close to the front lines just to understand what everyone who's working under him does. Not everyone in a position like yours would do that. So we think that's pretty cool and commendable. Thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you.
All right, coming up after the break, we're going to talk to T.R. Levin. He's a big deal in the world of colon cancer screening. We'll get him to talk to us about his research, finding joy in medicine, and maybe get him to tell us about the strangest thing he's ever pulled out of a person. In the meantime, enjoy this wonderful break music.
We're back with T.R. Levin, Chief of Gastroenterology for the Kaiser Permanente Diablo Service Area that covers Antioch and Walnut Creek in Northern California. In addition, he is the clinical lead for colorectal cancer screening for the Permanente Medical Group, and he's a national leader in that field and a nice guy. T.R., thank you for coming on to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you. How long have you been a GI doctor?
Since 1994.
I can't do math.
24 years, I'd say.
Wow.
If you Google your name, I don't know if you've done it recently, there's some pretty impressive stuff, like New England Journal articles and editorials, and it's really cool. It's impressive.
You know, you think that getting something published like that is going to change your life, but, you know, I still have to take out the garbage. And
people in your house don't care.
They don't care about any of that stuff.
You mean people don't stop you on the street either?
No, I tell my family that I'm really famous among a really, really small number of people.
Right. You're like, so I make sure to go to all the GI conferences because that's where the fame and glory are, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
DDW, ACG, that's where you're a rock star. So will you tell us a little bit about like what your research and all this fame comes from, sort of the root of it, because it is what, Joe, I'll tell you what we all do every day, colonoscopy and screening and colon cancer prevention is, and tell us why it's so important and how you got into it.
Well, I got into it actually during my training. I started working with a researcher at Kaiser Permanente in Northern California who had a ton of data, but nobody to help him analyze it. It was one of those opportunities that I just couldn't really pass up. And in those days, we were doing a lot of flexible sigmoidoscopy because it was easy, efficient, short procedure. People didn't have to get sedated. We thought it was going to be a big big seller. But it turns out that...
It was like the blockbuster of the GI world.
It was, actually.
Yeah.
And it turns out a lot of people don't actually want to do that test.
Will you tell briefly for our listeners and Joe, who might not know what a flexible sigmoidoscopy, or in the business we call it a flex sig, you know, just to make
so,
it...
She's so proud of herself, right, for knowing that.
That's like when you want to sell it to people, you just have to rebrand it. So we call it flex sigs because it sounds... That's
sounds pretty cool. What does that mean?
Yeah, it's not.
So here's what it is. You have... they're both like a long, thin, flexible tube with a camera and a light on the end of it, or a scope. And they both go in your bottom to take a look at your colon for different reasons. Screening, surveillance, looking for some source of bleeding, that all that. But the difference between them is, just like you mentioned, the sigmoidoscopy isn't as far. It doesn't go all the way through your colon. You don't have to take all that nasty prep to drink. You take a couple of enemas, maybe the morning of. But the downsides to them are that you're, one, usually not sedated for that.
That's kind of what I'm getting at. What kind of pain are we talking about for the patient?
There can be some cramping. You feel like you've got air, but the whole procedure takes about 5 minutes.
Right.
So that's really, for some people, that's a positive trade-off, and they'd rather not be sedated. It's kind of unusual here in Northern California. A lot of people want to be sedated, right, you know, 24 hours.
It's right. If you prepare somebody well enough, yeah, you know, it's a little bit of a grin and bear it, mind over matter. You know, we do colonoscopies. I'd say I do maybe 5 a year with no sedation at all. Patients just don't want to be sedated. There's all this fear surrounding sedation about long-term memory loss and, you know, you're losing an hour of your life. Like, you're not present.
Participation. There just weren't enough people really participating.
So it was effective, but just not utilized? Is that?
Yeah, people were put off by the idea of having this tube put in while they're awake. And even a lot of people just don't even want a colonoscopy. I mean, that's the other side of it. The world kind of breaks down into people who really want everything done. They want to have their whole colon looked at because they're scared of disease and they want to get the most complete exam possible. And or people who just don't want to do anything at all. And so how do you get those people in?
So taking a step back, though, from that, let's ask you a question that we get a lot. And why did you go into GI in the first place? Why are you doing this? Why did you do GI? Why do you like GI?
For me, it was actually, I kind of was on the fence between medicine and surgery. And actually, I had a latex allergy. And in the 90s, or late 80s, early 90s, those latex-free gloves were just not that common in the OR. So I literally would walk out of scrubbing into surgery as a medical student with rashes all over my hands. So that was one part of it. I went through a big part of my first couple of years of medical school thinking I was going to be a psychiatrist.
No kidding.
Actually, I'd been a psychology major in college and was just into all that stuff. And figured out that if you do gastroenterology, you get to practice a lot of psychiatry also.
Get to do a little bit. It is sort of a mixture of a little bit of procedural, sort of surgical type stuff,
right,
and
a little bit of like comforting and working through someone's psyche. That's totally a good point. Never thought of it that way.
I just thought endoscopy was kind of the coolest thing you could do. I even as a third year medical student, I saw one happen. I was like, that seems really cool. I want to learn how to do that stuff.
Yeah,
it's like sophisticated video games. That's how I pitch it to I mean, it's true. Yeah. I believe it. But that's usually what I say to patients.
Yeah, you get to do different things during the day. And we get to basically remove polyps, prevent cancer, and people don't walk out with a scar.
Yeah.
So you're just, as one of my attendings referred to it, as we use the body's natural openings to intervene.
Right. You've addressed this in some of the articles you've written, and you've talked about this before. But with the increasing number of people that are going to need colonoscopies in the coming years already, even without moving the goalpost a little closer, how are we as a medical community going to meet that demand? Do we have some plan for that, or is there some hope out there that we're going to be able to meet that demand?
Yeah, I think it's daunting. It's very daunting. I think, and it depends what kind of insurance you have in terms of your ability to get that access. It's, I think there's some people with good private insurance who, if you're in an urban area, you probably can find someone to do your colonoscopy. But, you know, in rural areas, in poor neighborhoods, this is an issue even in, a well wealthy city like New York City. There are parts of the city where people are live far away from anyone doing colonoscopy, even though they've said everyone should have a colonoscopy. So I think we need to balance and have alternatives to colonoscopy. So that's where the FIT test comes in. I think that's a great alternative. There's some newer technologies that are also available, potentially. We're still trying to work out the cost and the intervals for those and how often they need to be used, but I think there's a lot of promise in kind of non-colonoscopy technology. We do like to track our screening, and we're monitoring it pretty closely. And we're part of a consortium of several different sites kind of just tracking the use of screening tests and starting to see some things about... I mean, one thing is just follow-up, the importance of getting followed up after you have a non-invasive test and if it's positive. There's data that if you wait too long, you can... be diagnosed with a more advanced cancer than you would have been if you'd gotten it done, say, within 6 months.
Yeah.
So that's one important thing. So if you have it, a lot of people want to repeat the test when it's positive.
Yeah, they do.
It's really interesting to compare a positive FIT with a positive mammogram. There's something psychological about that. If a woman has a positive mammogram, they really don't want to wait 3 days to have a follow-up diagnostic mammogram. But if people have a positive FIT, they're gonna think about every other reason that could potentially cause blood in their stool instead of the polyp or cancer that we really want to find.
Yeah.
So
right.
I have hemorrhoids or whatever. You know, I've had this conversation with lots of people, and I tell them, you could have a polyp along with your hemorrhoids.
Right.
And
right.
That definitely happens.
I tell patients, I'm like, I can't ignore the test. I agree with you. I agree with you. It's probably hemorrhoids, but it's a positive test. And sometimes you have to, this sounds bad, bully them a little bit, If you didn't want a colonoscopy 100%, you didn't want it, then I wish we didn't have this test. But I can't make any recommendation other than recommend a colonoscopy.
Yeah.
So the barriers would be cost and ick factor, I guess, or fear, right, of a colonoscopy. So that's sort of hard to overcome those things.
There's definitely, and then colonoscopy takes a lot of planning.
Yeah.
You know, you've got to take a day off from work. Maybe you have to take the day off before because you're going to be on clear liquids the whole day and taking your prep. And not everyone can miss their work, or they lose income when they don't work, and everyone can afford that. And you have to get a driver.
Right. You need to inconvenience, some people can inconvenience themselves, but no one else. So anyway, I heard you recently speak about just physician wellness, and I wanted to ask you about that as well. And how you said how important physician recognition is sort of among that, the kind of goals to reach when we talk about wellness. And again, where does that come from and why is that important to you?
For the last, I'd say for the last 5 years or so, I've been talking to a lot of physicians. I've had different administrative jobs in our medical group. And, people sit in the regional offices or in the office of our physician in chief, and they come up with all these great ideas of things they want to implement and to make things better for patients. But I've had enough experience talking to physicians who are just so exhausted and just burnt out that the idea of them doing one additional thing or the idea of them doing one thing differently than they're used to doing was such a impossible sell because they had just no, it was like a rubber band, pulled so tight. People had no flexibility. So I feel like it's completely essential to our success as a medical group, but it's also essential for our patients because physicians who are burnt out are more likely to make mistakes. They're more likely to order unnecessary tests. They're more likely to just do things that are more costly. So it affects costs and risk and all sorts of things.
That second point is really interesting because I hadn't thought about that, but I can totally see that being true. If you are just burnout and you don't think a patient needs to undergo a test with some risk and some cost to it, instead of talking to them, talking them through it, explaining why, connecting with them, spending that emotional capital, if you are burnt out, you're not going to do that. You'll just sign off and be like, fine, we'll get a CT of everything, expose you to all that radiation and all that cost. Fine, whatever. I need to see my next patient.
And anything to end this conversation, right?
Yeah.
And I don't think a lot of us do that, but obviously it's in the moment of, for me, if I'm feeling that way, I'll call you tomorrow, and usually, cause I see that in myself, and I don't always, but when you feel like your thread is short or you're feeling impatient, I do procrastinate more, which I hope it's just a few hours or a day, but I'll just say I need to handle this tomorrow because I'm going to make a bad quick decision right now.
Yeah. And it's clear that evidence supports this in any studies. When there's higher rates of burnout, there's more, just it's costlier.
Yeah. Yeah,
and also sense. I think, you know, that there's also just the ethics of taking care of our colleagues and that they really need to, you know, just having compassion for our colleagues and the fact that any human capital is being wasted because it's not functioning at full capacity. So I'm what I would refer to as consciously incompetent about burnout. I kind of know that there's a problem, and I have been trying to learn as much as I can about solutions. Mm-hmm. We, in our physician group, we formed a little subgroup among the gastroenterology chiefs to look at this, and based on some feedback from surveys of the physicians from the end of last year, we picked kind of three areas to work on, and one is physician recognition. The other is make sure we're getting the most out of our support staff and really mm-hmm. getting our support staff helping us as much as possible. And then, you know, the thing that every physician likes to complain about is the electronic record and figuring out ways to get that record to work better for us. I think mm-hmm. as medical students or early career physicians, we have this belief that our notes have to be so detailed. And matter of fact, we would get graded on it probably as students, right. how complete our notes were. But that in the world of performance improvement or lean manufacturing, you might call that overprocessing. If you're putting too much detail in that is not necessarily going to change anything, you know, that first of all takes you longer and takes time away from other things you want to do. And if you're spending time typing all that in,
right.
you know, you can really, it makes your day a lot longer.
And I would also argue that just being someone else who's reading those notes, you don't necessarily get that much more from a really long note with lots of words and cut and paste sort of stuff versus a short description of what's going on and short explanation.
And most people, you know, don't spend enough time on the describing their thinking, the assessment part of the note, which is really where, that's what protects you in the case of a legal event. It's like, just, what were you thinking?
Just putting in words doesn't necessarily protect you, but putting in your thought process might. You mentioned recognition as well, though. What do you mean by that? Recognizing physicians for what they've done or achievements? Is that?
Well, there's, you know, there's a couple different forms of recognition. One is, you know, you take the person who did the best thing the whole year and you give them a trophy. Like we got man of the year, or as we called it this year, the most valuable gastroenterologist, the MVG. But which is fun, and you've got the one person who's getting it, but there are things that so many of us are doing every day that it seems like nobody's really paying attention or nobody cares. And I think it's those recognizing those moments are going to be really our key to success. And figuring out the way to do it in a way that is sincere, specific, you know, not just, oh, great job, and, you know, patting someone on the back, but really acknowledging what they did. And I think from what I've learned in my kind of early foray into this world, peer-to-peer recognition, hugely valuable. And if there's a way to somehow make that visible to other members of the team, so it's not just you talking to your colleague in their office, like, hey, thank you for covering my inbox, you did a great job, but actually doing it publicly in some ways. I mean, there are vendors that will sell you an app that you can put on the phone of every one of your employees where they, you know, a peer can recognize someone. I saw their website, and it's like you can record a short video about somebody gave a presentation in a meeting and record this video, and then suddenly like everyone in the company can see this video and it's like, hey, Jane's doing a great job. She did this great presentation. So think about, you know, every company kind of knows that every successful company knows this is an important part of their work.
Yeah.
And I think in healthcare, you know, it wasn't that long ago where we would complain, like, some of this work is not sustainable, there's too much of it, and we would get a response from the CEO, you know what's not sustainable? Not being able to pay your mortgage. That's not sustainable. And so, you know, so we have to just, you know, remember that we should, people respond to positive feedback and to, you know, pats on the back.
Yeah,
for sure.
It's really, really important. I never think of it in a hospital from a hospital standpoint, but in the business world, for sure. I think recognition oftentimes is more powerful when it is peer to peer and it's not necessarily any money involved, which is surprising.
Or even, you know, this one, so I'm reading one book, it talks about like just non cash compensation, but if you give somebody a gift certificate to a nice restaurant, and they take their spouse to that dinner, and then they have an experience based on that. Then every time they think of that experience, they'll associate a positive feeling with that. So we're finding ways to kind of get those experiences in there.
So the two important things is administrative buy-in, and you're, you know, a chief of GI, so it's great to see that, you know, and obviously you're getting support from your higher-ups too, because, you know, everyone talks about burnout, and I actually went to a conference in April. Everyone was talking about burnout and how frustrated everyone was, and honestly, a lot of the frustration there was no administrative buy-in, and I do feel like, from what you're saying, there is that, which I think is an X factor that I don't know how you, we all know that the more, you know, you spend on recognition and addressing burnout, the more retention, physician retention you'll have, the less like physician suicide, which is a problem.
Definitely a problem.
And that is a cost benefit, not, you know, physician retention is like, this is a business plan. You know, you have to sort of present it as a business plan. So,
No, and this one book I was reading, they talked about 1-2% of your payroll should be spent on recognition, which seems really high when you think about a lot, you know, during at least during non-recessionary years, a lot of companies are thinking about 3% increment in salary. So if you held back, say, 0.5% in the first year, just while you're learning how to do it, you could potentially get to that kind of an investment in a recognition program. But like you said, even non-monetary recognition is also super important.
Yeah.
Yeah, it is.
Well, there's something we typically ask all our GI doctors that come on the show or our ER friends and that come on the show, and you can't escape without us at least asking it. We always want to hear, because this is what the sickos who listen to our show want.
It's not us, it's just them.
But they always want to hear about your best foreign body extraction story, or if you have something from your 20 plus years of working in this field that you would be willing to share with us.
It could be anywhere from any 20 plus feet of the bowel, any part of the bowel.
Yeah. Well, there was definitely stories that I've heard and that I may not have necessarily been involved in, which was, especially during the early 90s, it was not uncommon for men to swallow Barbie doll heads and then have the experience of passing them rectally to kind of obtain some pleasure. At least one x-ray that I saw during my residency of kind of a stack of these heads lined up in the rectum, the sigma colon.
Wait, was it specifically Barbie or was it Ken?
I don't know. I heard it as Barbie, but it probably could have been anyone.
And did you ever ask any of these patients that, you know, did this actually give you pleasure, or was this just an urban legend that people were...
No, he saw it. He saw the x-ray.
No, I believe that you saw it.
I saw the x-ray, but I never actually asked the patient.
Right, I'm just curious, did it work? Or is it, you know, you hear urban legends, you know, if you inhale this or eat this Tide Pod, you're going to feel great. I want to know if once they pooped out the Barbie,
it worked.
Did they get pleasure?
I think as long as it wasn't overloaded, you know, I think it probably was.
Right.
The fact that they're in the hospital, though, tells me it didn't work.
Right.
Yeah. Well, there was too many of them.
Right. They were stuck, but maybe in the hospital as they passed them.
True.
Yeah. Who knows?
You know, they found the pot of gold at the end.
You know, if anyone else told me that story, I would call bullshit. But I believe you, and that's insane. That's one of the best ones I've heard.
I've never heard of anything like that. What, I don't get it. It's, maybe I'm dumb logistically. Why a
Barbie
doll?
Well, as it's passing, like,
is it the hair that, like...
No, it's not the hair. It's the shape. It's like a bead almost.
Yeah, it stimulates your prostate as it passes through the rectal area. But
what about G.I. Joe, guys?
I think
could be anyone.
I think I've played with both. And I think Barbie heads are a little bit bigger. I think G.I. Joe heads, as we all know, are tiny, tiny heads.
And they're harder.
The ones in the 80s and the 90s, you're correct.
That's
but
the old
school
with, I don't
G.I.
Even...
Joe dolls were the size of like Barbie dolls if we're going way back.
Yeah. Well, thank you for sharing.
Sure.
Well, TR, thank you so much for coming on the show. Mm-hmm. Thank you for all you do on a local level with your physicians and your group and in terms of recognition and trying to move physician well-being forward. And also on a national level, what you're doing with colon cancer screening and follow up of polyps and that sort of thing. It's really, really important, and I can't overstate that. I mean, we spend a lot of money as a country doing this sort of thing. We need to know what we're doing, and we need to know how to do it best. So you're really at the forefront of helping to figure that out. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Very, very, very inspiring.
Thank you for coming. Thanks for listening. Please keep up with the emails and phone calls. Keep them coming.
At hopquestions@gmail.com, and our phone number is 408-444-6623.
All antidotes and patient-related details have been changed with respect to date, sex, and certain details so that patient identification is not possible.